Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 50 branches worldwide. For more information, visit our website at www.westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 1st of July 2024, and this is episode 336. On today's podcast, I talk to two academics, Dr. Jonathan Krauss and Professor William Philpott, about their recent book on French generals during the Great War. These enigmatic figures commanded France's largest force on the Western Front. They faced triumphs, tribulation, victories, and mutinies. Yet, despite their pivotal role in securing victory over Imperial Germany, their stories have remained largely obscured to English-speaking audiences. In this episode, we look at the biographies of some of these remarkable leaders. Bill and Jonathan spoke to me from their respective offices in Oxford and London. Gentlemen, welcome to the Dispatches podcast. To begin with, could you tell us a bit about yourselves and what sparked your interest in the Great War and in particular French generals?
Bill, why don't you start?
I'm happy to. I guess I began studying French generals before Jonathan. long time ago, 30 plus years ago, when I did my own doctorate, it was on the subject of Anglo-French relations on the Western Front in the First World War. And that got me interested, of course, in broader aspects of the First World War, coalition war, moved on to engagement with operations, strategy, and all the sort of the developing debates about military performance in the First World War, particularly in relation to the British Army's performance. So I was sucked into those early elements of debates about command, tactics, operational control on the Western Front. And it struck me as those debates developed that essentially these were about a war between Britain and Germany, and that the major army that fought on the Western Front, the French army, had rather been sidelined in an Anglophone historiography. I guess it arose out of the well-known lions led by donkeys debate, a debate which doesn't really exist in France. There's no great controversy about their own military leaders, but it does, of course, raise the question, does the learning process apply also to the French army? So there was a clear gap in knowledge and understanding there to be filled. And in practical terms, actually, we are approached to edit this book by Pen and Sword as a companion volume to Ian Beckett and Daniel Corvey's probably well-known volume, Haig's Generals, with the idea that it would be produced in time for the centenary. It took us rather longer than that, but there we go.
For myself, it's in many ways quite a different story. So when I was an undergraduate in California, I really wanted to be a medievalist. I was taken in by the Hundred Years' War in particular and thought this is the way forward. And then one of my advisors took me aside and reminded me of the language requirements of doing such a thing. And I thought learning half a dozen dead languages just to do something that no one's going to care about probably isn't the right way forward. So I wanted something equal, what at the time, you know, as a very young man, 1920, I thought would be equally grim and brutal, but with fewer language requirements. And so it was with that idea that in 2005, I came to the UK, partially to visit a relative's family that I hadn't seen, or if I had seen them, I had been 2 years old in the 1980s. And I met Bill at that point. And I had some vague sense that I wanted to do First World War. And Bill suggested to me, well, why not do the French? The British are overdone. And the French, particularly at that time, felt fairly wide open. So that's what I did. And I went back to California. I spent a year taking French classes as an undergraduate. Had a breakup in French, which is always fantastic for language learning. And then showed up ready to do work. I've been doing that now for, 17 years, something like that.
Yes, it's amazing how the First World War just suck you into a never-ending sort of spiral, maybe upwards or downwards, but I'll let the listeners work that one out. Right, to your book, I wonder whether you could tell us about the broad structure of the book that we're discussing today and why you wrote it and what contribution you believe it makes to the field of French generalship and French generals in the First World War.
Shall I?
Yeah, go for it.
Kick off. What motivated us to write this book? I think what we found after Jonathan had begun his doctorate, there was a meeting of minds in the research community at King's College London. We got together, set up what we called the First World War Operations Research Group, which was a group of historians working on French themes, British themes, and German themes around the general themes of how warfare was changing on the Western Front between 1914 and 1918. And among the contributors of the book, we have Dr. Simon House, whose work you may know on 1914, Dr. Tim Gale, whose work you will probably know on the French armoured forces in the second half of the war, and also Jonathan himself, who completed his doctorate on the Battle of Artois in 1915. So these are three very important doctorates that I was supervising at the same time, which actually gave us more or less the whole chronology of the French army's performance on the Western Front between 1914 and 1918. This is around the same time I was working on my study of the Battle of the Somme, Bloody Victory. So we decided to pool this knowledge, bring in some other interested parties with expertise in the field. Michael Nyberg in the States, well known for his study of Foch and other dimensions of French history in the First World War. Martin Alexander, known for studying Gamelin in World War II, but chose to look at Gamelin's apprenticeship in the First World War. And who else? We got Paul Strong, looking at Nivelle. So we had a group of historians with a shared interest. We pulled together in what essentially is an edited collection, and Jonathan and I were putting our heads together to try to explain the process of the French army's development between 1914 and 1918, how its command style, its tactical operational practices were developed. And this was supposed to be a centenary volume, but life and other projects got in the way. It took over a decade to come to fruition. But I think that was a good thing. It allowed us to delve into the wealth of archive materials that were available in Vincennes that had been largely untouched by British historians, certainly, and not so much touched by French historians either. It allowed us to both reassess senior figures and to introduce some junior figures for the first time. It allowed us to cover the whole range of the war from 1914 to 1918. And I think also it allowed us to explain or present a more positive narrative of military developments occurring on the French sector of the Western Front, which is largely unknown territory to British readers. I appreciate that now, possibly in the 10 years we are writing the book, the French sector of the Western Front is increasingly discovered by battlefield tours and tourists, but it's still worth putting a structure to what is going on there by studying both the commanders who are active in that sector of the front and the operations that they conducted.
Yeah, one of the great challenges of writing about the French army for an Anglophone audience is how do you introduce it, right? So you can talk about size and scale and scope, but you get into this sort of Stalin-esque problem where, quantity has a quality all its own, fine, but it becomes too big, right? It's hard to properly understand and wrap your head around. And so it just becomes big numbers, battles that most people in the English-speaking world don't really care about. And so it just washes over them, right? And it's really hard to get a sense of what's actually happening, why it matters, and sort of recentering the French in this conflict, the Western part of the First World War. There's a reason why, as Bill or the rest of us would tell you, both armies and police forces and even some fire departments all over the world adapt something like the Cascadrien after the First World War. Same as many had adopted the Picohob after 1871, and they don't adopt that horrible flap thing the British wear for two world wars. So there's only so many ways to do that. Okay, yes, you could do big battles, a bit like Bill did with the Somme book. God, when was that? It was a decade ago now, something like that?
2009, yeah.
Jesus Christ. so we thought, again, with some prompting for Pen and Sword, of course, that introducing it through people, through personality, so through the generals, was one way to sort of help make this huge effort a bit more digestible, and also to get at some of the personal, professional, intellectual lives of some of these men, to make them men and not just be names or sort of vague ideas of leadership, which again is quite difficult. Compare that to the British, where to some extent, maybe even too much is known or bandied about, especially in a Western Front Association setting, with the personal quirks and lives and backstories of some figures, Hamilton or Gough or whomever else. We were never going to replace that or replicate that, and didn't try to. But to try to remind anyone in the present that people in the past were people. They lived, they died. And that's why the book is not just, it doesn't start in 1914, it doesn't end in 1918, right? It tries to piece together a broader sense of these individuals as people. And historicize that, with the war being, yes, a major part of their lives, but still just a part of their lives.
So before we actually touch on some of the individuals that you looked at, or certainly that your volume covers, could you just tell us about the state of research and writing the book? I was just wondering, obviously many of our listeners may have been to Kew and done that, but what's the sort of state of French archives and sort of French archival material during this period? Is it as rich as many people would might envision the British archives being in terms of letters, diaries, etc.?
Yeah, it's very different. It's very different on every level. And again, to an extent, and Bill, let me know if you disagree with this, part of it is just because of the scale and scope that we're talking about, right? So whereas a lot of British studies and a lot of the British documentation, it's easy to get down to really quite small tactical levels. And lots of individual stuff, in many ways, thanks to the Imperial War Museum and how that's been organized and put together. We don't really get the benefit of any of this with the French, right? So the basic unit of analysis is division, which is much higher than you're going to get for the British Army for most of the war. The French don't have something quite like the Imperial War Museum, so finding individual letters and diaries is much more hit and miss. Some of it is in Vincennes, but has all sorts of other sort of difficulties getting access, or trying to get access to Weygand's files, for example. So Foch's chief of staff, and then, of course, obviously the Second World War commander and the commander in Poland, or at least the back half of the Polish war, is surprisingly difficult. At least last time I tried, you still have to go through the family, which isn't easy. And of course, the archivists usually aren't too terribly willing to help you do that. So it's a much more challenging thing to dig down both to the lower levels tactically, but also into the personal stuff, or at least that's been my experience. Bill, I don't know if you would disagree with any of that.
Yeah, I would agree with you. If you want to analyze a military operation, the sources are vast, rich, badly organized, but they will be there. They're not weeded in the same way that British operational papers are weeded, but it therefore requires a more extensive and more intense process of research to get through to sift through the chaff to find the grains of wheat for which you can grow your intellectual argument, which is why, I mean, when Jonathan wrote his doctorate on the Battle of Artois, it's a relatively small engagement, but you can get a whole book subsequently out of it. Simon House also with his study of the Battle of the Ardennes, Lost Opportunity, which he is always proud to say, I studied one day in the war for my doctorate. But the wealth of material was so rich that it is it is possible to do that with the French archives. I would also echo Jonathan's explanation that you don't have what we call the personal archives, the personal papers that senior British officers often created left behind. The diaries are rarer, but when you do find them, they're brilliant sources. I made a great use of General Fayolle's diary, or Marshal Fayolle's diary, to be most accurate, but only in a 1964 published edition. The actual diary on which this was based has subsequently disappeared. There's no equivalent of Douglas Haig's diary for the senior French commanders. Foch left some very interesting notes, which are available actually in the Vagon papers, which on a different project I had access to many years ago before I wrote the Sombok. So I was able to use archive material I'd already gathered. But the French archives are both frustrating, but also worth persevering with. If you're really interested in the subject, you'll find an awful lot of brilliant material there.
I mean, one of the great things about the way the French do archives, and Bill touched on this, but I really want to sort of repeat it, is that because their idea of organization is to get a large box and just throw in everything vaguely related to a topic into the box, you will find all sorts of things that you wouldn't have known to look for, which when you're dealing with the National Archives here at Kew, very often you'll have a sense of something that should exist or that, you know, you think is out there, but just finding the folder, the files, actually can be surprisingly difficult, especially with the horrible online system. For Vincennes, okay, yes, they have digitized inventories now, but it's really just a huge PDF copy of the old books that were the version that both Bill and I used would have been compiled in the 1960s, if I'm right. And it's great, right? Because you can just go to it's ordered in lists, so units numbered 1 to whatever, and you find exactly what you're looking for. It's all laid out next to each other, and you can get all sorts of ideas about avenues to pursue without necessarily knowing ahead of time going in what you're looking for. And I find that much, much more difficult for the way the British have organized their files.
Can I just mention one positive? It's not about the archives, but the French official history is brilliant. It's extensive. It has lots of important documents. It is all searchable online through the Bibliothèque Nationale, their Gallica collection. So anyone wanting an entree into French archives for the First World War, I would thoroughly recommend that. The problem with the official history of the French army and their documentation is they look at how operations were prepared, but they don't go and explain what happened after the operation began in that detail. So if you want the interesting stuff, the after-battle reports, the assessments, essentially you have to go and find it in its original form in the archives at Vincennes.
I mean, the official history point's a really interesting one, right? Because I mean, there's, if we take sort of the big three, right? So the German, the British, and the French, they're written for very different purposes, and the effect is very different. And the French seem, or at least my students with the German is far more limited, but the French ones are some of the most accurate and dispassionate that you're likely to find. Occasionally, there's a little sardonic comment here or there, typical French, but they're rich, they're thick, they're detailed, and they draw directly from documents, which, as Bill mentioned, are then very often put into an appendix. You can attach specific passages, specific arguments, or specific sort of descriptions to specific documents, which is fantastic. And I don't know any other official history that's even tried to do anything like that. In many ways, because you don't have to, right? Because, you know, these are being written, at least the first drafts, first rounds, as early as the 1920s. And so, you know, modern archival research, as we would understand it today, is itself a very new thing, right? An archival organization, again, along the modern lines, even newer. So to create a system that effectively survives without the archives, by effectively just reproducing the most important documents, is incredible. And especially for students, graduate students who are interested in this, to get a sense of what some of these documents contain. Obviously, this has been reformatted for the official history, so they don't often look the way they would look in their actual original form. But to get a sense for that connection between narrative and document is such a fantastic learning tool.
So let's turn to some of the generals that you cover. I wonder whether you could highlight a few of these individuals and provide us with some insights into their leadership styles, contributions, and operational outcomes.
Bill, who did we write about?
Yes, it's a while you remember. Essentially, we looked at the usual suspects, the four senior commanders, Joffre, Pétain, Nivelle, and Foch. But then we went down to the next level of command, looked at some army group commanders, De Longue, De Cary, in the first part of the war, and Fayolle and Maistre later in the war. We looked at Pierre Roch, who was a army commander and subsequently Minister of War, a political general. We looked at Estienne, who was essentially the technical officer who set up the French army's tank corps. We looked at Maurice Gamelin, who was a staff officer and divisional commander in the First World War. That was his apprenticeship to become commander-in-chief, or actually chief of staff in the 1930s and then commander-in-chief in 1940. And I think I've missed someone else. Who else did we look at? Oh, yes. And I looked at myself, Marie-Eugène d'Aubigny, who was an emerging leader, an army commander by 1918, also an important staff officer who would end up chief of staff of the French army between the wars, actually responsible for commissioning the Maginot Line in the late 1920s. So we have a range of figures from early in the war to late in the war. And I think overall, for the figures already known, Joffre, Foch, Pétain, we tried to present a more positive, nuanced view of their contributions relative to what has come before. Joffre is a bit of a caricature. I wrote the Joffre chat to myself, and I tried to present him as a strategist of the new sort of attritional mass warfare that the French army would have to fight, whereas he's normally looked at as a tactician operational commander who fails when facing the challenges of the Western Front, although he's successful, of course, on the Marne in 1914. The other two that I think I would stress, Fayolle and Maistre, very important figures, both army group commanders by 1918. So under Pétain, essentially, they are directing French military operation on the Western Front. And they've left enough sources to be able to reconstruct their careers, particularly their learning process, their adaptation to the challenges of the Western Front, which I think is central to understanding the process of how armies and the men who commanded them were able to engage with and solve the challenges that they faced as warfare stalemated the end of 1914, as mass material essentially imposed their inevitable constraints upon warfare for what I would stress, when you look at the French approach to it, was a relatively short period of time. In 1915, tactical solutions were found. Jonathan will endorse that. That essentially is what he has studied in great depth. Operational solutions are found by 1916. And it's a matter of applying these appropriately in 1917, 1918 to defeat the German army with the right way and with the right people by this point in charge. Two interesting studies, De Longue, De Cary, Roch, are essentially studies of generals who survived from 1914, but by 1916 are moved aside because younger, more dynamic, more effective commanders are replacing them. Roch commands the First Army in the first half of the war. Second half of the war, it's commanded by d'Aubigny, who will leaders alongside the British in 1918 to great effect. We always think of the Battle of Amiens as the great Canadian-Australian stroke British success on the 8th of August. It's actually the Battle of Amiens-Montdidier. The Debonese French army is fighting alongside the Canadians as well, as effectively as the Commonwealth troops, or the Dominion troops, I should think we should call them. And his army demonstrates the great effect, the ability, the skill of French commanders and French troops on the battlefield come the summer of 1918, largely marginalised in very Anglo-centric accounts of the final 1918 offensive.
One of the things that's... So I know like the way the question was posed, in many ways, you probably want us to pick a couple of generals and go into it, but to an extent, it's harder to do than you might think because of how these careers intersect and overlap. So one of the things that we, I think we accomplished, I want to say we accomplished, is that, to echo Bill's point, we are able to break down some of the stereotypes around a lot of these people. Joffre, for example, but in particular, Foch and Pétain. So there's this moment in My Battle, such as it once was, in Artois in spring 1915, in which Pétain is furiously pushing at Foch, who's his superior at the time, and demanding that they push the attack home, that they just one more big push and they'll sort of crack the German line. And Foch says, no, sort of, you're being too aggressive. You need to pull back. We need to take our time. And if you were to, you know, I think take your average sort of reasonably well-read and sort of well-informed British First World War aficionado, they would assume that those roles would be reversed, that Pétain would be the one arguing for caution and Foch would be the one pushing. But these men, over the course of these 4 years, they go through changes, right? So Pétain initially is surprisingly aggressive, right? And it's only after the horrors of 1915, and in particular, I think, the September battles, that he becomes the Pétain that we meet, that many Anglophone historians meet for the first time at the Battle of Verdun. Likewise with Foch, he goes through this period, particularly after the Battle of the Somme, in which he's sort of sidelined and goes into the desert for 40 days and comes back with thinking, new thinking, operational thinking that would not just go on to win the war, but that would, in a roundabout way, form the basis of the creation of operational art and the formalization of this new level of command that isn't formally adopted by NATO forces until the 1980s. So, you know, to say that you want us to, let's say, sum up some of these men, even in a paragraph or a short conversation, is quite difficult. And one of the nice things about the book, I think, is that you can see that organic process of people trying something. Sometimes it works and it leads them down a blind alley. Sometimes it doesn't work and they're forced to reassess. And also the pressure that command puts on people, that people's response to combat and their personalities change, not just as they themselves change in an internal sort of sense, but as their roles in the army change. And so often what we think of as someone's personality is actually their role within an organization. And this is not just a military thing. It's not just a First World War thing. This is a life thing, right? So someone that may have been a bit more shoot from the hip at one stage of their life or career, military or otherwise, might become a bit more cautious and careful and concerned as they get more and more responsibility, because of course more and more is riding on their shoulders. And you see this as the vast majority of the people we look at do have a trajectory, right? They wind up by the end of the war at a more senior position than they were at the beginning. The exception would probably be Fayol, whose personality is so strong that I don't think anything could change that man. But I don't know how Bill feels about that.
Yeah, I think you're right there.
So in actually looking at some of these generals, are there any sort of lesser known or overlooked aspects that would strike the average, I suppose, British First World War anorak in terms of, obviously, you look at this in great detail, but are there sort of things that, you know, I as a British Army sort of nerd would think, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think you'd be surprised by the broad nature of the individuals who succeed in the French army in the First World War. I think you'd also be surprised by the amount of politics that's involved in the French army. It's a much more politicized army than the British army, certainly, and decisions to hire and fire senior commanders are often taken, if not directly in Paris, they often relate to the political processes going on behind the lines as much as the achievements of commanders at the front. I know there's a lot of humming and hawing about Haig's future by Lloyd George, but Lloyd George doesn't tend to get involved in decisions about more junior commanders in the way that French politicians do. What I'd also want to stress comes out of this research is how intellectual the French army and its commanders are. Not to say there aren't good old fighting soldiers involved as well. We didn't mention that there's also a chapter on Charles Magnan, notorious as a gung-ho fighting soldier, but a very successful one once he was because he was adaptable. He did get sacked on one occasion, but he was brought back. Very successful commander in 1918 who'd adapted to the new ways that the French army was fighting. But essentially, the military intellectual approach to the French army is key to understanding how they engaged with and became successful on the Western Front. Jonathan just mentioned Pétain and Foch in 1915, but actually fighting alongside them in exactly the same battle, Pétain was a corps commander. General Fayolle was one of his divisional commanders in that corps. Alongside them was an army corps commanded by General Maistre. All these four are the four top figures in the French army in 1918. But interestingly, they have a history. Unfortunately, I discovered it after the book went to press, but there's a little picture of the teaching staff of the École Supérieure de Guerre, the French Army Staff College of 1901. And sitting on one end of the line, there's Foch, and in front of him are Fayolle and Maistre, who are also professors at the Staff College. Maistre's actually Foch's deputy. If we'd taken this photograph in 1902, Pétain might also have been in the photograph. So we have four pre-war military thinkers, military intellectuals, often not identified as such, but it's these men who not only can fight, but who can also think, intellectualize, theorize, understand, and change the dynamics, the nature of warfare, who will be successful in the challenging environment that the Western Front presents after 1915.
And I think that this outcome, this actually is going out a bit on a limb here, but the French army before the war and consequently during the war is not the British army in a different color coat, right? Socially and organizationally, they're very, very different. And so they promote for different reasons and different types of people to begin with. So if you look at senior British leaders over the course of the First World War, particularly the higher up in the generalship, so often you'll see they went to the finest schools, they knew what fork to use, they attended the same dinner parties, these sorts of things. If you look at the backgrounds of a lot of the senior French generals, this could not be further from their experience, right? Some, yes, okay, you have de Castelnau, you do still have some fairly elite figures, people who were born into what was once sort of a French aristocracy. But it's a much more middle class, even if it's a prosperous middle class sort of institution. And to an extent, I think their education also reflects that. And when you have a formalized, in many ways, really quite modern education system for the French army, and if you go back and read Foch's lectures, from before the First World War, which are printed, or at least a big chunk of them are printed, they're not radically different from what you would imagine a contemporary lecture at a military academy to be like, which is partially, yes, drilling through the basics, but also very much a reflection on the changing operational environment, changing technology, and how that will or might look in the field, and trying to marry these things together with, of course, a big chunk of history attached into it, military history, which is not to say, of course, that the British are not being drilled in military history or tactics, et cetera, is particularly after the Boer War and the creation of a proper British general staff. But the fact that the leaders of the French army by the end of it are not dashing cavalrymen, right? They tend to be either infantry or artillery, or, I mean, Joffre's an engineer, right? These are much more academically, or at least some of them are much more academically rigorous backgrounds rather than backgrounds of privilege. And again, I think if you want to say, well, what would a British person be shocked by the French experience? It's that it's the whole, again, the lions led by donkeys thing, which one would hope, especially for people that are into the war, is long, long since gone, right? It's almost boring to even bring it up anymore. But it's so far from the truth for the French, and what little elements of it that persist come out of, you know, a handful of references from the 1960s of people with, let's say, you know, sort of questionable approaches to the war, probably questionable French levels, having this really thin caricature of French commanders that really couldn't be further from the truth. I'm thinking here of seeing Foch as portrayed actually in George Orwell, Down and Out in Paris and London. You know, no matter what happens, remember Foch, attaque, attaque, attaque. So, okay, yes, by the end of the war, Foch is saying, you know, attack, push, 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 but it's not a blind sort of aggression. It's tempo. It's using modern technology, using the railroad, using communications technology to keep the enemy off balance, to disrupt what Boyd 40 years later would refer to as the OODA loop, right? So to break down the Germans' ability to process what the Allies are doing, to respond effectively, which is a very modern and very sophisticated sort of approach that is boiled down in popular consciousness as sort of just a blind aggression, hoping for the best, which really couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah, I think that's a very good example. I think what we've done in this book is take caricatures and made them characters, living individuals. They don't perhaps deserve a whole biography. Foch certainly does, maybe Joffre, but the others, a chapter is adequate to explain who they were and why they're important and why they shouldn't be forgotten. They have important roles. And I would also stress we've only actually taken a very small sample of what could have been a much wider study. There's a lot more work to be done, firstly on the commanders and the commandees off of the French army, also on the operations the French army carries on. I'm not sure I'm in a position to take it on myself. I don't have another 10 years to French generals, but I could reel off a list of another dozen commanders who deserve to be looked at as well without breaking a sweat. There's important figures out there who are hopefully... our book will inspire others to brush up their schoolboy French or whatever language skills they have and get into the archives and see what's out there. It's interesting to me that a century later, we just passed through the war centenaries. I was expecting a lot of new material to come out on the French army in that period. The only books that came out were Jonathan's book on the Battle of Artois, Tim's books on the French armoured force, and Simon's book on the Ardennes, as far as I'm aware. I don't think I've missed any.
There's Greenhow's Cambridge book.
Greenhow's General Cambridge book on the French army, which is a very good introduction to the subject, more from a socio-political than a military perspective. Our standard military work is still Robert Doughty's Pyrrhic victory. But
which is 20 years old now.
Yeah, I know that. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's interesting that when I started doing my doctorate, which is 35 years ago now, the French army was an untilled field, and we're still only just ploughing the early furrows. And hopefully, in time, we'll get a much more nuanced understanding of its nature, its achievements that will match the very detailed and excellent understanding we have of the British and the increasing understanding we're getting of the German army as well, which is seen a renaissance in studies of the German army over the centenary period, certainly, interestingly, by the, I'll plug other members of the First World War Operations Research Group at King's, Jonathan Boff's study of Prince Ruprecht, and Tony Cowan's recent study of the Germans in 1917 holding out. But there's plenty more scope for excellent critical analysis of the French army along those lines in the future.
I mean, on this note, I mean, if we're talking about ways that Anglophones can or should think about taking this forward, I'd say two suggestions, if I may sort of preempt. One, which is so many of the already well-worn battlefields that British tourists and enthusiasts have been visiting for many decades now, either are also French battlefields, or they immediately are adjacent to or abut French efforts. Include that in what you're doing, right? The Battle of the Somme, shockingly, is not entirely fought north of the river. That's barely half the battlefield. And even then, you have French units north of the river from the very beginning, right? So by taking in a more holistic view of some of these engagements, one, British enthusiasts are going to get a better, a more accurate understanding of what happened in the first place, right? People at the time would not have felt this sharp distinction that is often sort of worked its way into how a lot of this war is remembered and talked about. And for anyone considering study, again, as French said, well, work up your French. The reality is that particularly if one's doing a military study, the number of cognate words is very high. You are not going to need to crack your dictionary to understand what infanterie, artillerie, cavalry means, right? And because this is military men writing, the sentences tend to be pretty short, pretty sharp, pretty straightforward. So from a linguistic perspective, it is really a pretty easy way to get into studying the history of a different country in a non-English language. There are going to be some technical terms that you'll come across, and no one has suffered from this more than Tim Gale, who has very quietly performed one of the most impressive acts of scholarship I've ever seen, and has had to effectively rebuild the French language and vocabulary for the internal combustion engine, because the terminology used in the early 20th century is totally different, or radically different, from the terminology used today. And he had to effectively reverse engineer long out of date engines to try to figure out what in the hell the French are talking about when they're putting together their French tank program. It's probably part of the reason why he's been able to, or had to, devote so much time, so many years and so many hours to just looking at the French tank program, because of what an incredible study that is. And if you had had, quite frankly, so he was doing this while working. If you had had this in the hands of a graduate student, someone in their early 20s, mid-20s, they couldn't have done it. They wouldn't have had the time, which is in many ways the last point, which is one of the things you'll notice as you go through this book, is how many of the contributors and authors are not full-time historians working in universities. We are one of the most lucky fields of history in that people who are passionate about it make real, meaningful contributions. Okay, so many other fields of history, maybe I'm being mean or naive or ignorant, the enthusiast writes, you know, really bad historical fiction. And, you know, there's a market for it. That's nice. But people who are really passionate about the First World War, and probably the Second as well, they make genuine scholarly contributions, articles, book chapters, entire books. And so there is a real need for people who have the sort of timeline and the patience and the fortitude to take on some of these topics that otherwise just aren't going to get done.
And to end with, where can people learn more about your work, and where can they get the book?
They can get the book almost anywhere. certainly your major retailers, Amazon, etc., online. And it's very affordable. This isn't one of these awful, you know, scholarly books that cost 60 quid. You can get a paperback for $9.99, right? And that's without a sale. So there's no reason why everyone shouldn't have at least three copies, right? So that's good. As far as our work, I mean, if you search Bill or I on any search engine, we will pop up. Bill's at King's, I'm currently at Oxford. We're not that difficult to find in that sense, unfortunately.
Yeah. Gentlemen, sorry, Bill.
Yeah, I would echo what Jonathan says. Pen and Sword will sell you the book directly from the publisher, but it should be available on all major platforms. So I'm not sure you'll find it on the bookshelves of your local Waterstones, but a specialist military bookshop hopefully will have a copy. But yeah, I think I'd like to just close by saying, rating back to what I again at the beginning, what started this off, the British learning process is now the standard narrative of the British experience in the First World War. And I think what we are asserting in this volume is that the learning process is universal, and the French army and its commanders are ahead in that process, the leaders of that process. The title Leading the Way, I think, indicates the message we're trying to get across. This is the biggest, the hardest fighting, and the best led army in the First World War. And you need to understand Germany's defeat and the British Army's progress as a fighting force in relation to the principal army on the Western Front that has sort of dropped out of the picture in historiography.
And on that bombshell, I'll say, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS2195. Until next time.